You're listening to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Thanks for joining us this morning. We've Stephen Ferris on the phone from Ireland. We've Hugh Cahill on the line from Japan. And a little later, Wes Liddy will be joining us to chip in on team selection. We're going to get to Razzie Erasmus's comments on Felix Jones, part of his team now. And we will also have a huge meander about the Pacific Nations and Tier 1 versus Tier 2 rugby, etc. We'll go to Hugh first because Hugh is in. Where are you, Hugh?
I'm in Hamamatsu, Dara. So welcome to Hamamatsu in Japan.
Okay, and tell us about that place because, forgive my ignorance, but don't know much about it.
Yeah, so we travelled up here basically after the opening game, and it's about 40 minutes train ride from Shizuoka, where the match is going to take place on Saturday. It's a city, it's very nice, and it's been kind of slowly filling with Irish over the last kind of day or two as people make their way from travelling around different parts to get as close to the match venue as they can. And this is handy in that Hamamatsu is a kind of a main interlinking train station, so you can go an awful lot of places in Japan from this central station. So it's handy as a kind of point of reference for the Irish travelling around, and they're starting to kind of fill in here now. As I said, the train goes directly to the stadium from here. It's about a half an hour, 35 minutes. Loads of hotels here as well, so they're all pretty much sold out, and we're expecting a large crowd this weekend.
So it's like the Limerick Junction of Japan.
Exactly, exactly. I couldn't have put it better myself.
Tell me, were you at the team announcement? Obviously, no, you're probably travelling, but what's the latest that you've got in close proximity to the team there?
Yeah, I was. I was there this morning. So we had the Irish team announcement at 1 o'clock local this afternoon, followed by the Japan team. So there was a good crowd, as there always is, and there kind of had been rumblings and rumours about the team selection that Joe Schmidt might go with, and the huge call obviously being Jack Carty to come in and start at fly half. Joey Carberry, we know, is fit. He's on the bench, and there's no room for Jonathan Sexton in the match 23, which is interesting for a couple of reasons. I'm sure Stevie will be able to elaborate on this, but primarily, I mean, his body language at training today wasn't great. Johnny Sexton, he didn't look too happy that he wasn't even in the match day 23. And, you know, Jack Carty has been told since Tuesday that he's starting this game to give him as much time to prepare for it. But, like, when you consider he wasn't an Ireland international at the start of this year, he's now about to start a crucial World Cup pool match against Japan. It really is quite the rise in terms of international standing for Jack Carty. Joey Carby is obviously back fit, which is brilliant. And he's going to be on the bench. You'd imagine he'd be keen to get some minutes under his belt. And Sexton's just going to have to sit it out and wait for another day. So that was the main news today, that Carty is in.
Yeah, and we won't bother talking about Sexton because it's all speculation. Obviously, that's the kind of the key point in general, and I'm reading different things. But you can tell place kicking is what gives his body more trouble than the famous targeting almost, Stephen.
For sure, of course it is. I think at the weekend there you witnessed Johnny Sexton withdraw himself from the place kicking duties. Conor Murray took that over. And if you're struggling with any type of groin issue, you know, running at the best of times can be a little bit niggly. So I can only imagine the kicking a ball wouldn't be the best idea, especially if you're trying to continue on playing within the game. So no, look, Johnny Sexton, I'm sure he's disappointed that another small niggle is probably keeping him out. If he had completed that game injury free, on top of his game, would he be selected for this game? I think he probably would, considering the rest of the selections that Joe has made. He's pretty much went full strength again, barring one or two. So, you know, if he hadn't have picked up that slight groin strain or bang to the quad or whatever it was, I'm pretty sure Johnny Sexton would have been starting again.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not, you know, we're not a medical program, but the quad and the groin, it's all connected. I know the quad kind of covers a multitude, but I suppose the groin, people can empathise quicker. If you're swinging your leg full tilt at a ball, you're going to get jarred there. But sure, look, that's rest time for him. Let's get back to the Carty story, because he had another injury, which was slightly different. I think he ripped his spleen on a water slide or something in Dubai, didn't he, years ago? I mean, that's some comeback for a guy 27, 28 to be shot into this now in an era where we're all talking about people being fully formed at 19, 20, 21, 22. That is a fairy tale, I suppose.
It is, absolutely. I think, you know, it's just brilliant that you know, the performances he's been putting in for Connacht over the last while has been recognised. He's got selected, and then when he was given his opportunity against Scotland off the bench last week, he took it with both hands. I thought he was absolutely superb. He recognised, you know, the Scottish defence, what he was playing in front of him. He played heads up rugby at times. His kicking game was pretty solid. He looked half decent in defence when he was called upon. So, you know, I think Joe was, you know, is happy enough to put faith into Jack Hardy for this match. And, you know, I think everybody, me included, expected another couple of changes. I thought, you know, the likes of Rory Best, after playing 80 minutes, might have got a bit of a rest. You know, maybe Cian Healy and Tadhg Furlong, they might have swapped those around. But, you know, fair play to Joe. He's went more or less full strength. And that will also give Jack Hardy a lot of confidence to see those other senior players around him in small moments in the game when, you know, it might not be going their way. It's not like it's a full second string Irish team with a lot of changes from last week. You know, Jack will be able to, you know, turn around and look to those senior players and get some advice and get some guidance throughout the match. So I'm really excited about it. I'm happy about it. I think that selection at the minute is justified considering the way he did play for the 20 minutes last week off the bench. So, you know, best of luck to him, and, you know, hopefully he goes really well.
Yeah, and he is very much a footballer, as they say. I know he was an excellent amateur and underage soccer player and got trials and all the rest of it. So it's the kind of game we might be able to see a little bit of that. But it's also, back to your point, Stephen, and throwing it to you, Hugh, about keeping a lot of the old stagers and the Rory Bests and Cian Healy's in the team. That's because this game is still a must-win World Cup game. And must-win, I say that in the sense of it's a losable game. Just about theoretically a losable game. We haven't seen the best of Japan yet, but they're no mugs.
And that's why I think, you know, it's so interesting that Schmidt has gone with Jack Hardy to start this. I mean, he was at pains to point out exactly what Stephen has just said in terms of his characteristics as a player. He described him as a very calm person, but equally on the pitch, that calmness transfers to if he makes an error, he doesn't get too phased about it, or he doesn't dwell on it, he moves on very quickly. You know, if a kick goes out in a full, or if he happens to throw a flat pass that is almost intercepted, as it was, you know, one of the warm-up matches against Wales, he doesn't dwell on it too much. And Schmidt just highlighted that characteristic, that part of his personality that he really admires. And himself and Rory Best today just spoke in glowing terms about him. I think more as a confidence boost, you know, rather than anything else, because as you say, this is a massive game. Ireland should beat Japan comfortably enough, but, you know, it is the second hardest game on paper in the pool. It is against the host nation. You're going to bring a massive crowd and a team that were, as you say, not at their very best against Russia, but they still did enough to look very impressive at times. And Ireland have to manage this game, I think, you know. Mm. You know, and Jack Carty is going to be the key pivot upon which the game is managed. He's the fly half. He's the guy calling the shots. So it's a huge, I suppose, sign of the faith that Schmidt has in a guy who's very inexperienced at this level, that he can step in and do a job here.
It is, and it's also another example, and I suppose Andrew Conway would stand out as a similar type of example, Stephen, that when Joe shows faith in you, that faith plus the actual knowledge that he imparts to you can improve you exponentially as a player in a relatively short time, both in your mindset and your skill set.
Yeah, definitely. Although, you know, Dara, I would say that, you know, Carty has been probably the most consistent, you know, out half within the Irish system for the last year or so. He's been superb week in, week out. He's never really let a side down. The likes of, you know, Sexton, you know, Johnny's had a couple of bad games over the last year or so. He's been out injured. He's been a little bit more inconsistent, where Carty just seems to be very, very steady. And against the Japanese team, that are going to come out firing at all cylinders, as you said there, they're going to bring huge support. Maybe it is that steady hand that you need. Maybe that is that game management. And to be called upon by Joe is giving him lots more confidence. And I feel that he won't let him down. He really won't. I don't think he's going to let anybody down. He's been superb. And I'm really excited, as I said there, to actually seeing him going out there, starting a game, and seeing how he manages the whole situation, because you know, it is such a big game. Japan are our biggest threat, I feel, in the rest of the group. But at the same time, I just can't see a Japan team beating us the way the confidence momentum are with the Irish team at the minute.
No, one would think that, but I suppose you and I on Saturday morning with Jamie and Eddie will be in the privileged position of of looking at that while Hugh and Donal commentate on it, and it'll be another buzzy morning. There's no two ways about it. But none of us think that there's going to be an upset here, which is brutal. Like, I mean, you really should not allow yourself as a professional sports journalist or contributor to say that. But I can't. I just can't see it going wrong this Saturday anyway.
No, I can't see it going wrong this Saturday. I think Hugh's exactly the same feeling as myself. I think just the team that's been put out by Joe Smith, as I said, I did expect a few more changes, but with this team, the experience, the know-how, the nous, the game management, like Farrell coming in, is such a big player off the bench for us last week. I just feel that, you know, it's a 15 or 20 point win if Ireland play to their potential. Even if, you know, Japan are, they are going to improve, they have to improve. You know, that outing against Russia was very un-Japan like, and I feel that they'll play much better rugby. But for me, I can only see one thing, and that's a half decent victory by Ireland.
As well as that, you know, just on the Sexton thing as well, I mean, like, he's only played 55 minutes of rugby really, you know, over the past number of weeks. Very limited in the warm-up games, as we know. Like, Joe Schmidt's going to have to play him again before the quarterfinals. And if you were Joe Schmidt, would you throw him out against the Russians, who are probably exhausted by this stage, or would you throw him out against Samoa, who could cut him in half and take him apart at every opportunity? You know, does it appear to you that he'd probably play against Russia and that could be it until the quarterfinals?
I think possibly. You know, I think a lot of it depends on Johnny's mindset, you know, and his headspace. Where is it at the minute? So if he's got a bit of a niggle, if he's not feeling 100%, then there's no point in playing him, because I think that is detrimental to the Irish performance. Johnny needs to be in the right frame of mind, and for him to be in the right frame of mind, he needs to be feeling 100%. So if he's feeling 100% getting into the Russia game, you play him against Russia. If he's not, then you play him against Samoa. I don't think it really matters. It's just making sure that he is in the right headspace, he's physically right, and you know, raring to go for a quarter final, which looks like it's going to be against South Africa. So I don't think it really matters, Hugh, if it's against Russia or Samoa.
Yeah, good enough. I mean, I'm going to come back to it in a second, but I'm just thinking, like, I mean, isn't life amazing? When you think of Jack Carty, again, last word on Jack, I mean, if you look back a couple of years ago, not alone would you have Johnny Sexton ahead of him, you'd have had and Joey Carberry, you'd have had Madigan, you'd have had Ross Byrne, you'd have had Paddy Jackson, you'd have arguably JJ Hanrahan, you could have even had Tyler Blyndell if he was qualified and all the rest of it. So you hang in there and things can happen. So I suppose that's from the point of view of the underdog story, it's a goodie, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's definitely a goodie. I think it's for anybody that's watched Irish rugby over the last decade, you know, there are opportunities for people to come in and grab a spot. And Jack Carty certainly done that. I know you talked about some of the players there that have, you know, slipped through the net or vanished out of the Irish system. But, you know, when you're given that opportunity, Dara, you have to go and take it. You know, it's not just as easy as going, oh, yeah, these lads aren't playing that well, now it's your go. When it is your go, you have to take it. And I think Jack Carty has been superb in the way he's went about his business. He's kept his head down. He's not trying to be the next Johnny Sexton and go out and, you know, be the talk of the newspapers and, you know, be the number one guy on the team. He's just keeping his head down and doing his own thing. And I think that's completely the right way to go about his business, especially when he is an understudy to the current world's best player. So, you know, fair play to him. And, you know, when an opportunity arises, you got to go and take it.
Just back to the fact that the likes of Healy and Best are getting another run on Saturday. Do we then think that there's some of our power players, so to speak, can take the last 2 weeks off to get really ripe for a quarterfinal, Hugh?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a sense of that. If they beat Japan, like, there's, you know, whatever about if anyone tries to put their best foot forward to make a case for Japan running Ireland close, which is difficult to do. I mean, the last two games should be really comfortable regardless of what team Joe Schmidt puts out. And I think there is a sense that, you know, by picking Keane Healy again, by picking Rory again, that he can afford then in the last 2 weeks to rest up some of the players, any kind of bumps or niggles ahead of a quarter final. And that's not to be arrogant about it, but that's just, you know, the way he has to plan it. You have to back yourself that you've picked a squad strong enough to compete regardless of who's out there. And Russia, as we know, you know, we'll really struggle against Ireland. I mean, if it's less than 50 points, that's a result for them. And then Samoa as well. I mean, how much have they got to give in the last game? and again, disciplinary issues already for them after their first game. So I think you're going to see that. And then, you know, maybe for someone like Johnny Sexton, who needs a good 60, 70 minutes, you know, you get him on board to guide the ship against Russia or Samoa. But Schmidt again today, he was asked about, is this his strongest possible team, you know, bearing in mind whatever bumps and niggles there might be. And he just, as he pointed out the whole time he's been here, it's about the squad. Anybody who gets the nod to start is good enough to play in that position and deserves to be there. So, you know, you go out there, you take it with both hands, and that's just been his mantra since day one, really.
And Stephen, as a man, Wes has joined us. Hi, Wes, how are you?
How are you? You well?
Yeah, not too bad. We're just chatting.
How are you, Wesley?
Hello, Hugh. You enjoying the land of the rising sun?
Ah, listen, absolutely. I the sumo culture, Wes, as you know well, no, it's second nature to be here now. We put on about 2 stones since I've been here, so all good.
Yeah, Fez is missing you. He's eating his weight in sushi just to mourn you while you're gone anyway.
Yeah, as the only man who knows the gym, I mean, can you power up for those 2 weeks? Is there some sort of magic kind of supercharging that could be done for some of our power players if they were rested for the Samoa and Russian games, Fez?
No,
it's all done, is it?
Absolutely. No, it's all done. It's all in the bank. You know, that really tough pre-season, the Carton House, they're over in Portugal. You know, those miles that have been done are certainly in the bank. But I think it's more about rest. It's more about making sure that you're just ready to explode when you get that call for the quarterfinal. And that's not necessarily, you know, from a physical side. That's, you know, mentally getting your head around things. So you can go hard, really hard in training, but when you're training, you're not taking the impacts. You know, they'll not be doing many full contact sessions in the midweek leading up to the games. So it's just about making sure that your headspace and your body is in good shape. A bit like I alluded to there with Johnny, being in the right frame of mind to take on games. So the likes of Cian Healy, Furlong, Best, Henderson, Ryan, you know, these are big, strong, physical men, and they just need their bodies to be right to perform.
Yes, Wes, big, strong, physical men, but we were laughing among one of our many WhatsApps last night, or I was laughing anyway at James Ryan because of the thought of him being Lions captain, which I'd obviously think would be a good idea if he stays in the same form. But he's not on Twitter anymore, which is another wise decision, or, you know, doesn't tweet. But I was looking back and I have to remember, like, as an old man, this is a very young man. A tweet he sent in the last year or two was, never thought I'd say this, but I think... And he mentions a Mexican restaurant has in fact overtaken Boojum, which is, I think, a burrito restaurant, is it?
Fascinating stuff.
And that's where that
man's head was at. It's a great insight into his dietary needs.
Yeah, just in case we forget, we're dealing with young men
here. After that tweet, I think it's the right idea to go off Twitter.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think Hugh appreciated you saying that Stephen was the only man on the phone that knew what the inside of a gym looked like either. Hugh's a big fitness fanatic as well. You know, I'm sure over there himself and Lenihan are really putting in the hours in the gym on the off days. You know.
We are actually, yeah. Donald's, yeah, he's fighting fit at the moment. I actually haven't seen him in the past few days, but he assures me that he's in fighting fit form. But yeah, I mean, just the Lions captaincy there, if that's the kind of level of stuff that James Ryan is coming out with, the old inspirational speeches might be in short supply. He was to be Lions captain. We won't judge him too harshly on that.
Oh, Stephen, you have to head off, I think, do you?
Yeah, I have to head off, but I'm absolutely buzzing for the weekend, so I'll catch us all then, boys.
See you Saturday.
Cheers, Steve. See you, Steve.
Yeah, okay, Wes, go on, give us your 2 cents worth on the team selection, because even as you joined in late there, I know you're going to have something interesting to say.
Well, I suppose just having heard you on Jack Carty, I mean, I guess he obviously performed really well the last day. He's performed well in the lead up. Is his selection prefaced against the injury doubts against Sexton and Carberry? Possibly. But other than Jack Carty, it looks a first choice team. Which maybe we're reading too much into it. I don't know if there's any feeling over there, Hugh, but does that mean, for example, that Chris Farrell is now notionally in our first choice 15?
I think an awful lot of people who perhaps didn't know a huge amount about Chris Farrell were pleasantly surprised by what he did against Scotland. I mean, for anyone who's followed Munster rugby, or if you've been kind of following his career, you know what he's been capable of. But I don't know if I would definitively say that it's now, you know, Chris Farrell, Ringrose, or Aki Ringrose. Aki came off, obviously, with that knock to the head.
It's unusual, after all the planning, to end up with two 13s playing in midfield.
Yeah, it is, and that's why he shifted it to 12, wasn't it, during the Italy game, and he started 12 there, and he has looked at him in training an awful lot at 12 as well. But yeah, I think again, this idea, a bit like, you know, to kind of broaden the point about what Hansen's doing with, you know, with Bowden Bard and Richie Moonga, having them playing in pods of three with Moonga at first choice fly half with the inside centre and his blindside winger, and then on second phase, Barra coming in as a 10 and using then the outside centre. I think, you know, Ringrose, you're going to watch Ringrose and Farrell interchange 12 and 13, I think, an awful lot. This weekend, and like it'd be interesting to see how Carty manages that as well. I wouldn't be surprised to see them like switching inside and outside and just kind of moving Japan around the pitch and keeping them guessing at all times, because I think that's again where Schmidt sees a big weakness in the Japanese team. And Russia had a certain amount of success with this in the opening game on Friday night, that when you move them around a bit, like positionally, they kind of get lost a little bit. Their structure isn't great. They look great when they're playing loose, fast, offloading ball and ball in hand. But defensively, Russia have made a lot of inroads by catching their fullback out of position, catching their centres not as quick off the mark as they should be. And I just think it'll be interesting to see if Carty takes it to the line, as he does for Connacht week in, week out, and plays that flat game to let the two lads go. I think they could do an awful lot of damage in the centre particularly.
Suppose it's... You could argue it's... I mean, I suppose the host country in Japan was always going to be billed as maybe the second most difficult game. I don't know if I agree. Samoa might be tougher. But it's possibly a little conservative in the sense of... And this isn't to knock management or anything, but I suppose with such a performance and so much confidence in the bank, and with our well-publicised difficulties of maintaining peak performance towards the latter end of the tournament, maybe there was an expectation on the back of Sunday that... there would be a few more changes. Maybe someone like, I know when I saw Dave Kilcoyne, for example, being wheeled out to the media, I assumed he was going to slot in.
But it's a four course meal, isn't it?
But what this means, I think, is if you look at previous evidence of Irish teams, is they've tended to get the strongest team out there the week before, you know, the provinces have put out their strongest team before in the Pro 14 game, the week before the Champions Cup. So if you follow that logic through, they're going to have to play full strength against Samoa.
Which is the most physical.
Yeah, well, and you haven't reduced the fatigue that much in the key players, because they'll have played three or four games, whereas maybe the opportunity was there for them to only play two or four games.
I'll humbly suggest, and Hugh, you come in this, that the paradigm has shifted because of the win against Scotland. It means that you can play chess any way you want now.
Yeah, I think so. And I tell you now as well, like even looking at the squad now, like look at the players, you know, the couple of guys that have come in, and look at the guys who haven't seen a minute of game time yet, or guys who haven't started yet. So Carberry, haven't seen a minute of him. Like, you know, we haven't seen Henshaw as well, and hopefully we will over the course of the next two games or so. You look at Rob Kearney coming back in today, Earl's starting his first game. Like, you know, the option of seeing like Jordan Larmour on the wing perhaps, or I just think there's so much strength and depth there now that Joe Schmidt has the luxury of being able to do what he likes in this pool. I don't think, you know, he is prioritising rest at this stage for some of his key guys at this stage of the tournament, i.e. our second game in. And I think he could comfortably play every player in this position now and rest them for the next two games if he so wanted.
I don't think he's going to want guys to have 3 weeks off going into a quarter final, though, if you take that approach, you would have to think.
Yeah, no, but that's fair. And that is fair enough. I mean, you could say they might be a bit undercooked, whatever like that. But I mean, I still think he could play... another couple of, I suppose 50% of this team could play again next week, and then 50% of that team could play again the following week while bringing in the guys who missed out, you know, because there's so much strength and depth there now. I think that
it's
he
three
has
four changes budget. Each game rather than whole team rotations, but
exactly.
Let's
that,
just stick with the kind of culinary analogies, like, you
well,
know,
well, just on that front though, right? on the rotation thing, like, I don't know if you got a different sense out there, Hugh, but I read a piece with Matt Todd this morning, the All Blacks backup open side notionally, and he made the point that there's a bunch of guys setting PBs in the gym and speed training this week. So that kind of, I don't know, from the layman's point of view, hints at maybe they hit the ground for South Africa and then they view this next extension almost as a mini refresher before the knockout stages come. And I suppose they've changed the structure of the tournament, except in England's pool, where the big games in the pool have tended to be in round one this time around.
Front loaded.
Is there a sense that the competition's kind of deprived of building a bit of momentum over there, because you're kind of facing into a lot of very one-sided games after that initial burst of big matches in the pools?
I think that's very gloomy.
Last weekend, Last weekend was brilliant, though. I mean, everyone... I think
it is, but the coming weeks won't have that same stockpile of
big
games.
Don't worry, there's 4,000 media accredited. They'll find something to give out about.
Yeah, and isn't that the nature of World Cup since 1987? That there's just been mismatches as part of the pool stages, and that's just
hang on a while. Has there? Like, I mean, everybody was kicking the World Rugby around the place because of the gulf between Tier 2 nations. And fair enough, I'm not saying there isn't. But I think this morning we saw Canada get hosed by Italy, and they managed to get a try. Otherwise, they'd have been nilled. It was 41-7 or 46-7 or something like that. But otherwise, Russia have surprised us.
But they haven't, though, Darren. They haven't surprised us. Like, they haven't. I mean, they got beaten by Japan. Japan playing at, I'd say, 60% of their ability. They went out and they gave a brave effort in their last game. Fine. Like, that's grand. But ultimately, it's all moral victories. Like, but it doesn't matter.
I know that. But the
matter.
Levels of fitness were like the day of the 55-60 minute performance at any level at this World Cup seems to have gone. We saw Uruguay, obviously, yesterday.
We are talking about Russia with 145 million population and massive financial backing, it being heroic that they lose by 30 points to an island of 200,000 people located in the third world. It's not that big of a surprise, really.
I suppose the rugby pedigree that Russia has is about as big as your little finger. I mean,
true.
The other fellas have a rugby culture, don't they?
No, absolutely. But I mean,
and plus, I think there was a fear of a repeat of the 95 All Blacks versus Japan kind of scorelines, and
it could happen yet.
Yeah,
it could happen yet.
I think Russia, in a weird way.
Stuff USA, by the way, today. And this is part of the World Cup. We all know it. There's no point trying to argue the case otherwise, because the other argument is not true. Like, there are too many one-sided games in a World Rugby World Cup, and that's until World Rugby do something about that is, you know, more meaningful than just placating teams. And I understand the counter argument that, you know, money won't solve everything, and certainly in the Pacific Islanders, you know, sometimes money...
It's like the Irish economy, though, Hugh. It's the squeezed middle in rugby that gets hit. The Tier 1 nations, i.e. the Six Nations and the Tri/Quad nations, whatever that's called, have the preparation time. It's not interfered with. Loads of money, etc. Countries like Russia, as we know from talking to Martin McDermott, have been on a circuit where, in terms of even qualifying for the World Cup, that they've had a huge... amount of time together, and their players generally aren't of a standard that they're being demanded by top clubs. It's those middle teams, namely the Pacific Islands, that are caught between two stools, that don't get the preparation time or the financial resource. Yeah. And so the, like you've seen in soccer tournaments
that's
in recent years with the likes of Iceland and teams like that, there is a chance in a tournament where teams that have been in a cocoon together and have huge amounts of preparation time, outside coaches brought in, and can develop an in-tournament momentum, which you see in every tournament in every sport.
Yes.
And, like, I wouldn't be for the island bashing where the sympathy seems to have gone against them all of a sudden. I still think they're getting absolutely shafted on any number of levels. When you see Nemanja Nandolo tweeting, good luck to Fiji, and you're going, well, you're their best player, mate. Where are you? Mm-hmm. He's in Montpellier getting paid.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, but I mean, again, you can't blame him for that, because his first priority is to go and earn a living, and if that means sticking by his club...
No, I'm not blaming him, but I'm blaming a system that facilitates that, essentially.
Are you blaming white males somewhere?
Of course, everything's their fault. Okay. Bar myself, obviously. But,
well, to flip it on the other side then, I mean, like, to give you the World Rugby viewpoint, like, if you're saying to yourself, right, World Rugby, right, and here's a load of cash that we want to inject into Fijian rugby to try and produce better players, to try and help them sort out a better system whereby they compete on a Tier 1 basis more consistently. But the people running the show in Fijian rugby haven't the first clue what they're doing. And, you know, whatever funds they do get, God knows where it's going to go. God knows what improvements you might see over the next few years, if any at all. And how long before you frustrate that to the point where you just say, right, lads, we want to help you here, but you're not helping yourselves. And, you know, there's only so many times that we can put the hand in the pocket and say, right, in good faith, go and invest and try and, you know, cobble some sort of system together whereby it improves the structures of the rugby in the game, and tangibly, so we can actually see the effect of that. There's only so many times they can go in and hand over the money and
it's
not
like,
see
it's
any
like the GAA analogy here when people talk about the resources Dublin have. And then when you talk about redistributing funds, people say, but are you going to entrust £1 million to all these county boards? Like, you're 100% right that maybe the money isn't being spent as it should in those countries. But I suppose when you're aspiring to be a global sport and you have really 10 to 12 countries where the sport is big, and you have a hugely talented base there, I would go to the ends of the earth to try and include them in the upper tier, rather than what will happen ultimately is they'll fall away from even the second tier. I guarantee you Fiji's priorities will be 100% going into sevens going forward.
Absolutely, absolutely.
As are Russia's now.
Yeah, well, Russia, I mean, Russia, look at it, they're tailor-made, the physical side of the game, you know, they've got that kind of machismo attitude about getting stuck in against, you know...
A Greystones kind of worldview, like.
No, more of a Streets of Limerick, I was going to say. But, like, that's, you know, the raw materials are there. The United States, look at the athletes that they have coming through, as you well know, Wes, having done research on that. So, like, the raw materials are there in an awful lot of these countries. I think World Rugby have, a huge duty to get... A fairer World Cup in terms of competitive levels, so we don't have these complete mismatches. But I don't know how you do it, and I don't think they know how to do it either.
Why don't you put together a kind of a two-tier system for a Fiji or for the tier twos in general, and fund a 12-month program for their kind of non-professional players to get that togetherness, and then catapult a few professional players in 3-4 months out? Is there anything?
This is like soccer, though. Now at this point, with any promising 15 or 16 year old in Fiji is catered for. And it's this notion of keep them at home or put them in programs, it's not based in the real world at all.
But then what can you do?
I mean if you look at the USA that Hugh mentioned there, right, and they will get stuffed by England today, but their front row is Titi Lamasatele from Saracens, David Anu from Toulouse, and Joe Tafiti from Worcester. Top class players across the board. There's other guys there like Paul Lasique from Harlequins in the centre, and a couple of other guys of that ability sprinkled throughout the team. The four or five outliers aren't the problem for countries like that, because they'll throw them up. It's how do you ensure that the remainder, the non-stars that haven't, how do you ensure that they have the best possible
you
preparation
for competitiveness?
You pay
them from central funds, which World Rugby hands over and monitors in a paternalistic kind of way, which would piss some people off, I guess, but they'd have to have some sort of controls over it, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, it is a very difficult one to assess, because you're handing over money to governance structures that you're not sure you can vouch for 100%, and then if you can, maybe there's a plant involved. I mean, it's a long way off trying to see maybe a true 20-team competitive tournament,
I agree that the status quo suits Tier 1s just dandy. But more to the point, it doesn't suit Tier 1's federations as much as it suits privately owned clubs in England and France.
Yeah, and I think that chances are that only becomes more pronounced with, you know, some of the developments we've seen.
We'll come back to CVC Capital.
All that stuff. Yeah. So...
Look at the progress of the last few years. Like, we're talking about a World Cup now in 2019, where you can make a really hardcore argument for any one of, say, 8 teams to win it. And, like, that's progress in the space of 12 years, I'd argue. You know, go back to 2011 or in New Zealand, you know, you could maybe make an argument that there were 4, maybe 3 teams that could win it. There are now 8 that can win this tournament. And find one or two of those, you might say, come on, that's a little bit far-fetched. But fine.
You have a half a dozen. You can make a case
at least 6. And I would argue even maybe, pushing it. So, like, I think that's progress. And World Rugby will kind of say, well, okay, fine. You can't have everything.
Journalists
overnight
don't have a vocabulary to actually point out what's been done well by people in suits without thinking that they're somehow exposing themselves as capitalist running dogs, you know? And I mean, then that leads to an imbalance in the debate, because whoever just points the finger at structures,
pointing the finger at structures.
Easy to have a cut.
It's like with anything, and it's a real bugbear of mine, but you hate to see untapped potential. And there is 3 or 4 clear markets in rugby. One being the islands, another being America, and maybe Russia even fall into that category, where there is so much ability that isn't being maximised.
Yeah,
Fijians are the best natural rugby players in the world.
Yeah,
full stop.
The recent World Rugby don't help themselves with this recent talk of the Nations League, and sure, we'll rank it in the top teams in the world, but sure, we won't actually. We'll just throw USA in there because there's money, and we'll throw Germany in because they're mad to get on board. So, like, that doesn't help anything, you know, when you have ridiculous sentiments like that, not based on merit, not based on ranking, and completely ignoring the Islanders, as Wes said, have so much raw materials, but get very little to show for it on the international stage. Like, they don't help themselves there. So there's so many arguments here. We go round in circles all day. But you know, it's
some of the points there are refreshing, and they're good to talk about. Because my only point, and I'm not claiming that I have any great knowledge on it, is that I just get bored when I see the knee jerk reaction from, in the broadest terms, rugby media saying, "Oh, tier one countries looking down their nose on tier two, typical, something needs to be done." I mean, I'm sick of the whole "something needs to be done." Go out and make a suggestion or shut your hole is basically what I'd say.
Could you put that in an email to World Rugby for us there and send it off?
I'll be on to Brett now in a minute. What's happening over there? Give us some fun. Who did you bump into? Did you bump into any strangers from the past over there in green jerseys?
There's a few floating around. There's kind of people are slow to come in. But I tell you what, it's a great country. It's a brilliant country. This whole notion of people respecting each other's space, cleanliness, tidiness, politeness. It's completely foreign to the country we're living in at the moment, and indeed most of Europe. But this place is amazing for that. And I'm genuinely amazed and taken aback every time I'm walking through the streets or getting on trains, that there's no pushing, there's no shoving. There's just, you know, people respect each other. They're polite to each other. And it's all a culture of just embracing society. And like, you go into the Jacks in the train station and you could eat your dinner off the floor. I tell you what, you get the keys there and into O'Connolly Station and you'd be taking your life in your hands. So like, it's an amazing to walk around and see this. And as a country, I think it's fantastic. There is an issue here with people speaking English, in that there was a survey done, I was reading in one of the papers this week, a survey done recently that found the average scores for Japanese students taking speaking English classes was a bit like Wes when he's at the leaving, an average of 30% across the board. So, like,
it's funny. I was just thinking when you mentioned Connolly Station, I don't think you've been on the Dart from Greystones past Sydney Parade since you went to Dublin Zoo on a school trip in second or third class.
I haven't been past Dalkey, actually.
Yes, your knowledge of the Japanese deprived underclass is very, very sketchy there. I mean, but no, do you know what? You're right. Because
did you cover up your tattoos for the Yakuza accusations that the Samoans fell victim to?
What's
as
he
well?
Got, like Calvin and Hobbes on his ass or something? Being bourgeois. Like.
Just Calvin, actually. It was an artist's perception of me when I was.
He has come on the stones across his left bicep.
No, he's not here. We could gang up on him. But you know, interesting, like about the politeness. I lived in Japan in '91, many moons ago, for three years, and of course that was a factor. But I was reading recently: was politeness a construct by a bourgeois construct, and you know, just general civility? Because like us all, it's easy. Leave someone out in traffic. Say thank you. If you give someone a cup of coffee, say, do it with a smile, all of this stuff, which you kind of get slagged off for being some sort of bourgeois for doing. But apparently Trotsky wrote about it, and he said it would be an essential part of any functioning Marxist republic or Marxist state would be what we call civility.
Yeah, and it is as simple and as basic as that, Darren. It is civility, and it is respect for the common good, right? So if we all keep the streets clean, the common good is we have a beautiful city to walk around in. If we all, you know, mind each other getting onto trains and queue, right? Queue as in one behind the other, and respect the queuing system, no matter how late you are, that you will get on, and that people and society will benefit, and the trains won't be late, and we'll all make it to work on time. It is as basic and as simple as that, yet it is completely foreign to most of the people that come here, and it does take a while to get used to it. And when you get used to it, you find yourself being kind of caught up in the habit of it. And you know, for me, it's going to be here for what's the 7 weeks for it. Like, it's, you know, it just, it makes everything a lot more relaxing, and as the aggression is taken out of life, and the rush to get nowhere, you know, at any cost is taken out of it. And I'm telling you, it's just refreshing.
It is to have some sort of sense of commonality with your fellow wage slave takes the sting out of the whole process. All right. But when you come back, you might go around to Michael's and Zaga and give them a bit of lesson in some of that common civility.
There's no hope for those lads, I can tell you.
Okay, Wes, because everybody's obsessed. And with the South Africa quarterfinal, which may or may not happen, but probably will. In fairness, including the South Africans, they're looking at that direction as well. So it's not just crazy optimistic Irish. Tell us what Razzie had to say.
I just saw a little snippet where he was asked a question about what Felix Jones brought to the South African setup. And he went out of his way, maybe it's mind games, but he went out of his way to mention his strength at analysing opposition individuals and defensive systems. And from what I know of him, he is quite strong in that regard. I know it's been kind of mentioned, but I mean, it is a huge coup, purely in the light of that potential fixture, which looks like it's going to come to pass now.
As the British parliamentarians would say, it's a bit like crossing the floor.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, having just worked with Munster the last few years, he will have done endless analysis sessions on Leinster, Connacht, Ulster. He obviously will know the players that were under his own tutelage well. And look, we hear all these expressions that become twee, but they become twee because they're said so much there's truth in them. And it is a game of fine margins. And you just start to wonder, you know, if there was a suggestion of a lack of a cerebral approach from the South Africans beyond Route 1, maybe Felix's insight can give him 2 or 3% of detail in a potential quarterfinal.
I would never have been dismissive of South Africans as that. They have that, but they have brains as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there was a sense against New Zealand that there maybe wasn't a lot happening beyond, you know, the usual high-pressure game they tried to inflict, whether that be via kick chase, blitz defence, pick your poison. So it's an interesting, it's very interesting just to watch how that plays out.
Well, it is. What we're talking about is there an NDA culture in rugby? And the bottom line is there isn't, because it's so ruthless. Fellas need to find a job.
Absolutely.
And their CV is their intelligence, is their data, isn't it?
Yeah, and a World Cup is such a shop window. I mean, one of the things that's caught my eye, since, you know, you're always looking for different trends, but just like the quality of individual performances has been brilliant from, you know, the Japanese.
Matsushita.
I won't even try. They got the hat-trick. You look at Liuwa with Samoa on the wing the other day, who's like great player. I remember him with the Hurricanes before he went to Wasps. You know, I remember Munster were in the market for a centre at the time and thinking how great a signing he would have been. Someone like Ardie Savea looks a player transformed. Anton Leonard Brown. So, I mean, it's a shop window for everyone. Coaches and players.
Yeah.
And that's one of the interesting subplots to watch throughout, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. We forget that it is a global marketplace. We'll leave it there. Thanks for your time again, Wes. Thanks to the lads in Japan. And Stephen Ferris will be back with myself and Eddie O'Sullivan and Jamie Heaslip on Saturday morning for live coverage. It's also on RTE Radio 1 and on our digital platform. So big weekend ahead. Hope you can join us for all or some of it. Till then, go easy.